Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Phil Dierking, Dan Friedel, and Brian Lynn. Later, John Russell and Alice Bryant will bring us this week's lesson in everyday grammar. But first, 30 years after the world's worst nuclear disaster, Chernobyl is about to become a solar farm. Officials in Ukraine plan to build a solar energy plant at the Chernobyl nuclear site. The announcement comes during the week of the 31st anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear accident. The Chernobyl accident occurred on April 26, 1986. The incident would become the world's worst nuclear accident. 32 people died, and dozens of others suffered painful radiation burns. Until recently, the government of Ukraine has largely ignored the area. Ostap Simirak is Ukraine's Minister of Ecology. He spoke with VOA about the planned solar project.
Today, almost a year after we have started the work, I can announce the first private investment project working in the Chernobyl zone to build a small solar energy plant.
Simirak says more than 50 national and international companies have expressed interest in building the solar plant. He adds that when completed, the project will produce about half the power produced by the Chernobyl nuclear plant. Officials expect to complete the solar plant project in May.
Louise Lawrence Israels did not own many things during the 3 years she spent hiding from Nazis in Amsterdam. But she did possess a small toy chair. It was a gift for her second birthday, and it meant everything to Lawrence Israels. She kept it her entire time in hiding, not far from the house where Anne Frank wrote in her diary. Now, this chair is joining thousands of other artifacts at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's new Conservation and Research Center. The center opened on Monday, the annual Memorial Day for the 6 million Jews killed by Nazi Germany during World War II. Donating the chair was not easy for Lawrence Israels, who is now 75 years old. "It was a big thing for me to actually give the chair," she said. "A lot of people can look at it and see how it was for a little child in hiding." More than 20 other Holocaust survivors joined Lawrence Israels for the center's opening. The David and Phyllis Chappelle Family Collections, Conservation, and Research Center is in Washington, D.C. It is a large, modern building with space for documents and artifacts, and a lot of room to grow. The artifacts at the center are kept in eight climate-controlled rooms in a building designed to survive weather storms. The collection includes many artifacts of everyday objects, from children's toys and clothes to sewing machines used in concentration camps. Travis Roxlow, director of collection services, said center officials have spent 25 years gathering the items. "We collect stories, and all of the objects that go along with those stories, because as the surviving generation passes on, these are going to be the objects that are left to help us tell the history of the Holocaust," Roxlow said. For the survivors, they feel that protecting this collection of artifacts is important for preserving the reality of the Holocaust. "I think the most important thing is to make sure that the memory of the Holocaust isn't forgotten," said 75-year-old Alfred Munzer. Munzer donated a silver teething ring, which was with him at the age of 9 months, when he was hiding with a Dutch-Indonesian family in the Netherlands in 1942. He also donated two small pictures of him that his mother kept hidden while she was in concentration camps. According to Munzer, who currently lives in Washington, D.C., the center and its artifacts will serve as a lesson to the world as to where hate can lead to. The other Holocaust survivors are not going to be here forever, said Lawrence Israels. "Once we're not here anymore, the museum and this institution will speak for us." She added, "This is the only evidence that we leave behind. And with the climate today, it's important that people see that this was real," she said. Researchers will be able to use the materials in the center. A reading room will open in the next year. The museum also is in the process of making documents and images available online. I'm Phil Dierking.
A drug used to treat severe bleeding could save thousands of lives for mothers giving birth. A global trial of the drug found it reduced the risk of bleeding deaths during childbirth by nearly one-third. The study involved 20,000 women in 21 countries, mainly in Africa and Asia. The trial was carried out by London's School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. The drug is called tranexamic acid. It is low cost, and researchers said it does not cause serious side effects for mothers or babies. The drug was first developed by Japanese scientists in the 1960s, but no long-term studies of it were completed until now. The drug is used to treat mothers for severe bleeding during childbirth, also known as postpartum hemorrhage. Postpartum hemorrhage is the leading cause of maternal death worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. More than 100,000 women die of the condition each year. Halima Shakur is the project director for the trial. She says despite medical advances in many countries, severe bleeding after childbirth remains a big problem in some parts of the world.
It's one of the biggest killer of mothers. You know, mothers go into childbirth expecting everything to happen normally. But in Africa and Asia, about 10% of women will end up with severe bleeding.
The drug works by stopping blood clots from breaking down after a mother gives birth. The treatment can prevent the need for doctors to perform surgery to find the source of bleeding. Shakur said the best results were reported when the drug was given to women as soon as possible after childbirth.
The earlier you give it, so within the first 3 hours of giving birth, the better the effect. Overall, we saw a 20% reduction in death due to bleeding, whereas in women who received the treatment within the first 3 hours, it was 30%.
The next step will be to get the drug where it is needed and provide training to doctors and nurses on how to use it. During the trial, women were given the drug through an intravenous line in a hospital setting. But researchers are looking for easier ways to administer the drug so it can be more widely used in small clinics and rural areas. I'm Brian Lynn.
American researcher Kenneth Miller has been working with victims of war for more than 25 years. Miller is a trained psychologist. In school, he studied the mind and human behavior. He says most of what has been written about war over the years tells about soldiers and their experiences. But very little, he thought, was ever written about civilians, so he decided to write a book. His book, War Torn, Stories of Courage, Love, and Resilience, describes the experiences of several civilians, including refugees. Miller wrote about people like 31-year-old Mustafa Hamed, a Syrian refugee who today lives in Germany. Hamed tried to cross the border between Syria and Turkey 8 times, but was always stopped and sent home. On the 9th try, he made it. Now Hamed is working hard to make a life for himself in Germany, but it is not easy.
The most important thing is you are lost here, so you have to find a new job, new friends, and you have to find a new life, so this is a new start for me.
His dream is to get a job in the news media, but first, he has to overcome some of the bad memories he has of living in Aleppo, one of the cities most affected by the war in Syria. Hamed has bad dreams and remembers bombs exploding nearby.
You can imagine, you know, it was daily, and you can hear every night bombing someplace near you, maybe for just 2 kilometers. You know, the electricity was cut down for a long time, so you have to wait for 7 hours or 8 hours just to charge your mobile phone.
The new book also tells about an Afghan man named Samad Khan. He was a refugee in the 1980s. At the time, Afghanistan was in the middle of a conflict involving pro-government fighters, forces from the Soviet Union, and rebels known as Mujahideen. While driving on a mountain road, Khan had a terrible accident. Many members of his family died in the crash. Khan felt guilty about the traffic accident for a long time, but many years later, he felt better. He became a leader in his community and seemed happy. Khan told Kenneth Miller about the accident during a counseling session. Miller could not believe Khan had recovered so well from such a bad experience. He said that his family, friends, and belief in God helped him get better. Miller said he included Khan's story because it seemed to have a lot in common with other refugees from around the world.
We are more alike than we're different. And his story also captures something we see in a lot of refugee communities, which is war, of course, can be devastating, but we are also built to heal. If the conditions are supportive and safe and stable, people have a remarkable capacity to be resilient and to heal.
Miller also wrote about a young man, Emilio, who settled in Canada. He was forced out of Guatemala because of fighting in a village close to where he grew up. He and his family fled the country and went to a refugee camp in Mexico. Emilio now works as a musician and is doing wonderfully well because of the support he received from his family, Miller said. Along with family support, Miller identified ways to help refugees feel comfortable in their new surroundings. He said the refugees need to feel welcome, be offered training in the local language, and be given financial support or a chance to work. If they face discrimination, it will be harder for them to become part of a new society.
The more people feel marginalized and discriminated, of course, the harder it is for them to integrate and the harder it is for them to heal.
I'm Dan Friedel.
This is What's Trending Today. David Dow, a doctor from Kentucky, was dragged off a United Airlines flight earlier this month. Videos taken by other passengers showed blood coming from his mouth, and the news of the incident made headlines around the world. Then, just this week, a large rabbit died after being flown from Heathrow Airport in London to Chicago. The rabbit was only 10 months old, in good health, and almost 1 meter long. Its father is certified by the Guinness World Records as the world's longest at 1.22 meters. In late March, United also received some bad publicity when two girls were stopped from getting on a plane. The airline said they were not wearing clothes the airline considered suitable. Now the airline has created or updated new policies, which could prevent some of the problems from happening in the future. United's CEO, Oscar Munoz, said our policies got in the way of our values and that procedures prevented employees from doing what's right. One of the new policies is that United can offer people up to $10,000 to leave their seat if the flight has too many passengers. United also said it will not prevent people from flying if they are already seated on the plane. Other parts of the plan include allowing airline workers to solve problems in the moment instead of relying on strict guidelines. In addition, the airline will give passengers whose bags have been permanently lost $1,500 without asking for details of the contents. Reuters news agency reports Dow applauds the airline for the changes. On Thursday, he also accepted a settlement with the airline for his treatment earlier this month. That means he and his lawyer will not pursue a public lawsuit. And that's what's trending today. I'm Ana Mateo.
The Big Lebowski is an American movie that has developed a large following. Since its release in the late 1990s, the film has been shown at film festivals, colleges, and special events. Many college students have spent evenings watching this film instead of doing their homework. One famous quote from the movie is this.
And even if he's a lazy man, and the dude was most certainly that, quite possibly the laziest in Los Angeles County, which would place him high in the running for laziest worldwide.
You can learn a lot from this quote about a lazy man. You can learn about a common feature of everyday speech in America, the use of adjective clauses. In today's report, we are going to explore how Americans use a type of adjective clause, sometimes called a sentence relative, in everyday speech.
A clause is a group of words that has a subject and a predicate. It does not act as a sentence on its own. Instead, it is part of a longer sentence. One common type of clause is the relative clause. These clauses begin with relative pronouns such as that or which, and act as adjectives in a sentence. For example, consider the sentence, "The book that my friend gave me is very boring." In the sentence, the words "that my friend gave me" make up a relative clause that acts as an adjective for the noun book. Today, we are discussing how Americans use adjective clauses that begin with the word which. You will often hear speakers use these clauses to modify an entire idea, not just a noun. Susan Conrad and Douglas Biber are English grammar experts. They say these special clauses that always use which are called sentence relatives. If this sounds difficult to understand, don't worry. We will give you many examples to clarify this point. Today, we are going to show you two of the most common uses of sentence relatives.
Americans often use sentence relatives when they are expressing a feeling or a value judgment. For example, a speaker may be talking about an idea. The sentence relative gives more information about the idea. Consider this famous scene from the 1954 film On the Waterfront.
"You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody. Instead of a bum, which is what I am, let's face it."
Here, the main idea is that the character sees himself as a failure. The sentence relative, "which is what I am," expresses a feeling or value judgment about his situation. Marlon Brando's fictional character does not feel good about his life. He is saying that, in his opinion, his life has little value. Speakers do not always use sentence relatives to talk about their unhappiness. Indeed, speakers can use these structures to show happy feelings, too. Consider this example. Two schools sent him acceptance letters, which is great news. Here, the sentence relative, which is great news, shows the speaker's feelings about the statement in the first part of the sentence. This is an optimistic, positive use of a sentence relative. You will hear it often in everyday speech.
Americans also commonly use sentence relatives to interpret information. Consider this line from the 1960 film, The Apartment.
Our home office has 31,259 employees, which is more than the entire population of Natchez, Mississippi.
In the quote, the sentence relative, which is more than the entire population of Natchez, Mississippi, interprets information in the main part of the sentence. The main part of the sentence is, our home office has 31,259 employees. Using a sentence relative is a quick way to give and interpret information. If the same scene did not have the sentence relative, it might sound like this.
Our home office has 31,259 employees. 31,259 employees is more than the entire population of Natchez, Mississippi.
These lines are not as interesting as the line you heard from the movie. Why? Probably because it repeats information while the line from the movie uses the sentence relative to give new information.
Now that we have discussed two common uses of sentence relatives, think back to the film The Big Lebowski.
And even if he's a lazy man, and the dude was most certainly that, quite possibly the laziest in Los Angeles County, which would place him high in the running for laziest worldwide.
Did you notice that the quote has one of the sentence relatives we talked about today? Can you recognize how the speaker is using it? Do you think it is to express a feeling, to interpret information, or to show something else? Write to us in the comments section of our website or on our Facebook page. Sentence relatives are very common in speaking. They are polite and acceptable in almost any situation. You will hear them every day in American workplaces, schools, airports, and so on. However, you should know that the structures we have talked about today are not as common in different kinds of writing. While you might read them in a newspaper or in fictional writing, say Conrad and Biber, you are less likely to see them in academic writing.
That's all for today's program. We will be back next week, which means you will get to learn more grammar. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm John Russell.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.